Okay. Good morning, everyone. So the title of the conference is Low Energy Challenges for High Energy Physics. So in this talk, I'll try to translate what that statement may mean for beyond the standard model physics, which is a big part of what particle physics is all about. So this is a bit out of the ordinary because traditionally, particle physics has been associated with extremely high energies through collider searches. Every time we're building a collider of higher and higher energy, we would discover a new particle, with the latest success being the discovery of the Higgs in July 2012. But if you look in the broad range of energy scales that we are familiar with, from the biggest length scale that we know of, the size of the universe, to the smallest length scale, the Planck scale, there is a lot left to explore. And the way that many of the new physics signatures can manifest themselves is not by going to high energies, by doing precision experiments. Or sometimes it's referred to as the precision frontier or the low energy frontier. And this is a direction that has been pursued for quite some time now in the field. Take, for example, electric dipole moment searches. These have been done from the 50s or 60s. But what is new is that while particle physics was mostly focusing on how to discover new physics through colliders, there has been great advances in other fields of physics. And there have been now several ideas in the past few years of how to use these advances to look for beyond the standard model physics in the precision frontier. Now, this can be what this new physics is can be many things. Can be anything from new particles, dark matter, new dimensions of space, modifications of general relativity. And there's all sorts of experiments looking each one for each one of those things. And it's impossible to cover everything in the context of a talk. So I will pick one of those. And perhaps the most easy thing to digest, because people are most familiar with, is dark matter. Dark matter, we believe, is a large fraction of the energy budget of the universe. We've seen it through its gravitational effects on galaxies, on the CMB, and we know we call it matter because it behaves exactly like ordinary matter, but it's dark, so it doesn't interact with light, and we've seen it purely through its gravitational effects. So now, okay, now that we've seen it only through gravitational interactions, you go to your favorite particle physics friend or theorist friend and you ask him, okay, what is dark matter? What is it made out of? And then you get as many answers as there are physicists, basically, particle physicists, because we have a lot of models for it. We have a lot of ideas what it could be. If you were to try to put the scale of dark matter to classify the dark matter candidates in an energy scale, you would have a range of 90 orders of magnitude, 90, okay? So that would start from the low end. You have 10 to the minus 22 EV. The dark matter, if it's a particle, and at those low masses, it can only be a boson, it has such a large de Broglie wavelength that it doesn't fit inside galaxies anymore. So from structure formation, we know that the dark matter has to be a particle. If it's a particle, it has to be heavier than 10 to the minus 22 EV. Now, you go higher in energy, you cross the Planck scale. Now we start talking about composite things or primordial black holes. And then you hit another wall at around 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 solar masses, which is about 10 to the 70, 70 EV. And this is when dark matter becomes too granular to observe the structure that we see. So it's just not fuzzy enough anymore. So within these 90 orders of magnitude, we've populated with all sorts of ideas, okay? Now, the next question you ask your theorist friend is, okay, how is your dark matter candidate produced? And in fact, this is where most ideas fail. An affirmative answer to this question is what made the weakly interactive massive particles extremely popular. I mean, it was for other reasons, but one of them was this. If you have a particle that has a mass around the Higgs mass at 100 GeV or 1 TeV, and it interacts with us with the strength of the weak interactions, it would be in thermal equilibrium in the end of the universe, and its freeze-out abundance, its leftover abundance when the interactions freeze out because the particles cannot found themselves anymore, matches the observed abundance of dark matter. So it can be a thermal relic. Okay? So this gave a huge push to the WIMP paradigm. Another class of dark matter particles that has been largely overlooked, and this is what I'm be focusing on, that has another type non-thermal production mechanism, and I think can be equally well motivated, are bosonic dark matter. There, they can be produced something called the misalignment mechanism, and I will explain what that is. This is a non-thermal production mechanism that produces cold dark matter. Now, the last question you ask, okay, we have a dark matter candidate, we know how the dark matter is produced. The next question you ask, okay, how do we characterize its properties? And luckily for us, how do we build experiments? Does it have interactions other than gravitational? Luckily for us, in most cases, the answer is yes. And I will discuss some types of couplings that the dark matter can have. But in principle, in the end, I will also entertain the idea that it only interacts with gravitational strength, okay? So this brings us to, and this is an outline of what we'll talk about. So I will motivate bosonic dark matter. In particular, we'll talk about light dark matter, extremely light in some cases, can be as light as 10 to the minus 22 eV. And I will describe, if I have time, three ways that you can look for it, that in principle look for different types of couplings, or different types of couplings for this dark matter. And in the end, I will tell you about how you could see it through something called black hole superradiance if it only interacts with us gravitational. Okay? So the best known dark matter candidate, the most best motivated dark matter candidate for dark matter, if it's bosonic, is something called the QCD axion. This is a particle that's motivated by the strong CP problem. Now, in the standard model Lagrangian, you can write a term that kind of looks like that. And for more formal people, this is a very crude way of writing this coupling. So basically, there can be a term that effectively mixes the electric field of the strong interactions with the magnetic field of the strong interactions. So it's CP violating. And it's not forbidden by any of the symmetries of the standard model because CP is violated in the standard model. And if the and its effects are parameterized by this angle theta S, which we expect to be order one. If it were order one, we should have seen an electric dipole moment for the neutron a long, long time ago. And we haven't. In fact, the only thing we've managed to do is constrain this parameter to be less than 1 part in 10 to the 10. So, as I said, this has been a problem for a while. And back in the late 70s, early 80s, people suggested a solution for it, for this problem, by turning this theta parameter into a dynamical field, which they call the axion. Now, this axion acquires a mass from non-perturbative QCD effects. And if it's there in the spectrum, it's extremely light. In fact, for some parts of the parameter space, it can have a Compton wavelength as big as 3 kilometers for a decay constant of close to the gut scale. Decay constant is a single parameter that determines the axion's properties, its mass and its interactions. So in fact, as a dark matter candidate, the axion is a great one because all the properties are characterized by a single number, okay? So it's a great experimental target. in a way, besides being well motivated. Now, if you extend the standard model even more, and you go to theories like string theory, you find that the axion, the QCD axion, may not come by itself. It may come with particles that have similar properties to it. And the reason is the following. The reason is that string theory has the way to see this is that string theory has three basic elements. First of all, it has extra dimensions that are needed for the theory to be mathematically consistent. But these theories need to be compactified. It has fields, particles that live in these extra dimensions. And there is also topology. Because we need to compactify these extra dimensions, we need to give them a shape. And depending, and there are many ways you can compactify these extra dimensions, which can be very simple, like a sphere, or can be very complex, like some sort of kalabiya. Whatever the imagination of the theorist that comes up with a compactification can be. So these different compactifications correspond to different low energy spectrum four dimensions. Okay, and effectively, basically they correspond to different theories. So, and effectively, this is the idea that these ingredients gave rise to the idea of the multiverse. Okay, the idea of the many universes that arise from string theory, which is much hated, but it is. An inevitable, it appears to be an inevitable conclusion of the theory. Of course, there is no way to see these universes. The interesting thing is that these same ingredients that give rise to this perhaps monstrosity also give rise to a plenitude of massless or nearly massless particles that can appear as for this, that we can detect in our universe. Okay? These arise as non-trivial gauge field compactifications, and they can have similar properties as the axion. A way to understand what happens, why these states are there, is to consider something that you all have seen from your quantum mechanics class, the Harrón-Ofbaum effect. So if you take a solenoid, and you have a magnetic field going through it, if you take an electron around the solenoid in a region where the magnetic field is zero, so there's no force on the electron, the phase of the wave function of the electron acquires a non-trivial phase. So even though, again, it's in a region where the force on it is zero. So the way, so the point is, this is what we call a non-trivial gauge field configuration for the electromagnetic field now. So there is no real, the potential, the electromagnetic potential around the solenoid has a non-trivial configuration that cannot be gauged away everywhere. Now let's turn this by 90 degrees. And even though the electron had a non-trivial effect in a region where the B field is zero, so you would say, oh, there is no energy in the configuration. There is still energy stored in the center of the solenoid because we had to drive a current through the solenoid to turn on the magnetic field. Okay? What non-trivial geometry allows you to do, topology allows you to do, is to remove the region where you would have the would-be magnetic field, removing the region where you would have energy stored, but at the same time, leaving the non-trivial gauge field configuration intact. Okay? This is a way where, so this is, can be done in geometry with non-trivial topology. You end up with gauge field configurations that carry no energy. So in four dimensions, this corresponds to massless particles. In fact, these particles are, in reality, are almost massless. They gain sometimes mass from non-perturbative effects. So in principle, they manifest themselves in two categories. If they are spin zero particles, they are very similar to the QCD axion, so we call them axions. If they are spin one, they can also be spin one. their properties are extremely similar to the to our ordinary photon. The difference is that they can have a mass. Okay. Now the final thing, there is another class of particles that are actually the ones responsible for giving these extra dimensions their non-trivial topology. And these go by the name of dilatons, moduli, the radion. These are also fields that in principle, because they couple extremely weakly, they can be very light. And they can form the packet of particles that arises from string theory. So all of these particles have some common characteristics. They all, as I said, they all interact with us extremely quickly, and they can be extremely, extremely light, and they're all excellent dark matter candidates. So what happens if they are the dark matter? And I'll explain to you also how they're produced. So usually, when you think of dark matter, the first thing that comes to mind is a picture that kind of looks like this. So you have particles kind of like molecules in a gas that move around in the galaxy. And this picture is quite appropriate, for example, something like a wimp. But in reality, quantum mechanics tells you that you shouldn't think about them as point particles. You should think about them as wave packets, whose extent is set by the de Broglie wavelength. Now, when the dark matter is heavy, these wave packets are well separated from each other. So either you think about them as point particles or wave packets, they should give you the same. It's very easy to treat them equivalently. Now, as you make the mass lighter and lighter, eventually what you will see is that the wave packets expand because their size is inversely proportional to the mass, and there will be some point where they would start overlapping. For fermions, this cannot happen, of course, because of Pauli's exclusion principle. And turns out there is a cosmological constraint on the fermionic dark matter mass, which is about 70 eV, 70. And it tells you that because of, and this is the regime where the fermions would be couldn't be more closely, that you don't have enough Fermi levels inside the galaxy, so you cannot fill the dark matter with the galaxies with fermions. For bosons, though, there is no such obstruction. Okay, and bosons can keep overlapping. And then, at that point, it's much more convenient to start thinking about dark matter instead of individual particles, to start thinking of them as a single wave. Okay. This is similar that can happen, for example, in a laser. In a laser, when you shoot it inside a cavity, if the intensity of the laser is very high, you talk about the electromagnetic modes of the field inside the cavity. But if you start making the intensity of the laser less and less, then you start talking about the cavity being occupied by single modes, a single photon modes. So as I said, this happens when the number density becomes larger than the volume occupied by a single particle, which is set by the de Broglie wavelength of the particle. In our galaxy, this tells you that this happens for dark matter candidates that are lighter than roughly 1 eV. Then we can describe dark matter with a wave, with a field, that has amplitude phi naught, which is set by the square root of the dark matter density and its inversely proportional to the dark matter mass, and a frequency, which is basically set by the total energy, rest mass plus kinetic energy, of the dark matter particle. For things that are inside the galaxy, this is basically dominated by the dark matter mass, because dark matter inside the galaxy is basically non-relativistic. And this wave, I've written here as monochromatic, but it's not really. Turns out there is a spread in frequencies because dark matter can be virialized. So then there is, for our galaxy, this gives a spread in frequencies of this wave, or a finite coherence time, if you will, which is 1 part in 10 to the 6 of the nominal frequency. Okay? So how are they produced? How come they are there? So if you look at the equation of motion, cosmological equation of motion for a scalar field, you see that it looks extremely similar to that of a harmonic oscillator, simple harmonic oscillator. There is the mass term, which corresponds to the resonant frequency. There is a friction term, which is the Hubble term. Basically, Hubble expansion acts like a friction for scalar fields cosmologically. So if you draw the potential energy versus the scalar field value, in the early universe, Hubble is very high. So it can be much higher than the mass for these light fields. So your harmonic oscillator is overdone. So if it sits somewhere away from its minimum, it will be stuck there. And there is reasons we don't expect for this scalar field, because Hubble in the early universe is so much larger than the mass, this equilibrium position is in no way special. In fact, even during inflation, this field can have quantum jumps, which will push it away, will have a random walk that will push it away from the minimum, even if it originally starts there for whatever reason. Now, as the universe cools down, Hubble drops, and eventually your harmonic oscillator transitions from being from the overdamped regime to the underdamped regime. And then it starts doing what it's supposed to do, it starts oscillating. So when you calculate at that point, when you calculate the energy density stored in this harmonic oscillator, you find that it gets diluted like the scale factor to the third power, just like cold dark matter is supposed to do. Okay. Today, the amplitude is much smaller than it was early on when the harmonic oscillator starts oscillating. And if we were to compare it to the Planck mass, you'll see that this is 1 part in 10 to the 12 oscillation for a particle that has a mass of 10 to the minus 18 eV, or about 1,000 seconds of oscillation period. In terms of distances, this is like a comparable Compton wavelength. It's a Compton wavelength comparable to the Earth-Sun distance. So we're talking about an extremely, extremely light, very fuzzy particle. So, okay, and I compare the value of the oscillation compared to the Planck scale for reasons that will become more obvious later. So the question is, okay, we have this dark matter produced by the misalignment mechanism. How do we see it? The way we see it is, it means other than gravitational, depends on the type of dark matter it is. And whether it's an axion or a dark photon or some modulus, by assigning each one of these three types have different types of couplings that we expect to see. So if it's an axion, it can be converted in the presence of a background magnetic field into a photon. And this is what happens. Actually, I present this first because this is the first coupling that's been employed to look for axions, in particular the QCD axion in a laboratory setting, with the ADMX experiment. There they have a cavity, an electromagnetic cavity, embedded in a strong magnetic field, and the size of the cavity, the size of the cavity matches the Compton wavelength of the axion. So you get the resonant conversions of axions into photons. There are proposals of how to extend the reach of the ADMX experiment at lower frequencies or even higher frequencies. But again, I mentioned the ADMX experiment because it's a milestone experiment. In fact, it's the first experiment that we have that probes the QCD axion parameter space in the laboratory. So far, we've only been able to constrain these properties from astrophysics. Axions are parity-odd particles, so they couple to spin, and they can mediate forces. Or if they are the dark matter, they can make spin precess. So this is another type of coupling that has led to several proposals, like Casper, that you will hear about in the next talk. Now, if it's a dark photon, a spin one, the way it couples to us is by kinetically, the simplest way it can couple to us is by kinetically mixing with our photon. So basically, if a dark photon is there and it's a dark matter, every electron appears to be millicharged under the dark matter. So basically, you can detect it exactly. It shares many of the properties of the photon. So you can detect it exactly like a photon. So if you were to take a photon detector and shield it from any ordinary standard model source of radio waves or photon waves, you could still see a signal in your detector because of the dark matter, okay, if it's a dark photon. Now, finally, the last class of particles that I will talk about are moduli, and I will focus more of those on those because they are not, many people are not as familiar with them. So moduli, as I said, are particles that determine the shape of the extra dimensions in string theory, and they also set the values of the measured fundamental constants, for example, the electron charge or the electron mass, the value of the strong of the strong scale, of the QCD scale. And they couple with terms that look like this, okay? So this is the electron mass. This is your dark matter field. And this D parameterizes the strength of coupling of phi to matter relative to gravity, okay? Now, if such a field is the dark matter, and it will be oscillating locally, due to couplings like this, it will mediate this oscillation to the fundamental constants. So that means that fundamental constants locally, if these moduli are the dark matter, they wouldn't be constants. In fact, they would have an imprint of the same oscillation of the dark matter. So you will see oscillations in fundamental constants. How big are these oscillations? I've picked the electron mass modulus coupling because, for reasons that you will see later. It's actually one of the easiest to understand. So if you have this type of coupling of phi, the modulus dark matter coupling to the electron mass, then the electron mass locally will oscillate with an amplitude that if the coupling strength D relative to gravity is 1, then it will be 1 part in 10 to the 12 roughly, for a dark matter mass of 10 to the minus 18 eV, okay? So we're talking about tiny fractional variations, tiny, extremely tiny. In fact, many of the plots that you will see, the variation is much smaller than that. But it also tells you that you need an extremely sensitive probe to see this, which brings us back to the precision frontier. Indirectly, light scalars have already been looked for because they mediate modifications of Newton's law at macroscopic distances, but they also can mediate equivalence principle violations. Now, if you have something, a scalar field that cares about the composition, let's say it only couples to the electron content of a mass, then masses with different electron content will experience different accelerations under this field. So this would be an apparent equivalence principle violation, and in fact, these are the most stringent constraints for large part of the parameter space for this field. So how do you look for these type of oscillations? Which brings us to atomic clocks, okay? Atomic clocks, as the word suggests, are clocks whose ticking rate is set at the transition frequency, at the frequency of an atomic transition. Okay, this transition can be an optical transition, it can be a hyperfine transition, or it can even be a nuclear transition. And this is more futuristic, and I'll talk about that later. As you see, all of these transitions depend on fundamental constants. So if the dark matter causes any of these fundamental constants to oscillate, the oscillation from the dark matter will be communicated to the ticking rate of atomic clocks. And atomic clocks are a great probe for this. We have defined our second, the definition of the second comes from atomic clocks. In fact, there are ways to, just to give you an idea of how precise they are. So a wristwatch, like with some measure, it loses 1 second every year. An atomic clock loses 1 second every age of the universe. Okay, or even better than that. Actually, right now there are clocks that are even more stable than that. Okay. So this translates one part in 10 to the 18 stability. So I presented a value, a benchmark value for the dark matter vacillation of one part in 10 to the 13. So you already see that atomic clocks are already a good probe of this type of dark matter. How do they work? So the way, and this is a very, for people in the audience that know about how atomic clocks work, this is a very crude sketch of how they work. So in these experiments, you pick an atomic transition, and I will tell you how you pick, it will become obvious how you pick that atomic transition later, and you shine a laser on it. The goal is to change, slightly change the frequency of the laser so that it's resonant with the atomic transition. And when you achieve that, you see the atom fluoresce. It emits light, spontaneously emits light. So by measuring then now, the laser frequency is tuned to the excitation energy, to this excitation energy of the atomic transition. How well can you tune the frequency of the laser to this atomic transition? So what is your fractional frequency uncertainty? So first of all, it depends on the ratio between the lifetime, the decay rate of the atomic transitions versus the frequency. And this is because this is the uncertainty of the photon that's emitted by the atom, okay? So now you see the reason you pick, the way you pick atomic transitions is in a way to make this ratio as small as possible. So for example, for ytterbium clocks, which are optical clocks, this is a ratio in one part in 10 to the 16. So this ratio is exactly what is responsible for the extreme stability of atomic clocks. And then you also gain by observing more atoms. This is just by observing a single atom, but you also gain by acquiring more statistics, by observing more of the same atom at once, and by repeating your experiment several times, okay? So the square root of the times, tau cycling is the time it takes to do a single measurement, which is roughly the lifetime of the transition, okay? So how do you look for that dark, for the dark matter now? So you take two different clocks, and I talk about two different because you want the dark matter to couple differently on each one depending on what fundamental constant you want. Because if you compare two clocks that are the same, the effects of the dark matter will cancel out, okay? So you want two different types of clocks, and you register the value, the ratio of their frequencies every, as fast as you can, every tau cycle, okay? Then you take that data and you take a Fourier transform of the data. If there is a dark matter signature in your signal, you should see a peak at a certain frequency in your Fourier transform. This also tells you that atomic clocks, the way they are operated now, are essentially broadband searches. They can, by taking data from tau cycling to the duration of your experiment, let's say a year, you can probe periods that fall anywhere within this 1 second to a year timescale, which is roughly 7 orders of magnitude. As I said, you need to compare different transitions. You have to compare an optical transition to a hyperfine transition, and each comparison gives you different sensitivity to different types of fundamental constants. Okay.
So you have two. I didn't understand. You have two because you use one of them as a control.
Exactly, because you need to control systematics. For example, one of the systematics is gravity itself. Atomic clocks are so precise that they feel the difference. If you have the same clock here and here, this measures the phase shift. So you need to have them collocated or somehow cancel. And gravity, because it doesn't violate the equivalence principle, when you take the ratio, will cancel out.
Okay. But clocks will interact with the dark matter. In a sense, they both.
Exactly. The point is that they need to interact differently with it. So if you have, for example, a hyperfine transition, and an optical transition, and you have something that couples to the electron charge. For an optical transition, the power of the fine structure constant that the energy difference depends on is different. Okay? So when you take the ratio, that dependence doesn't cancel out. So it's very important that they couple differently on the atomic clocks, which most of the time, if the clocks are collocated, that we'll talk about if you use the same clock at the end. But yes, it's very important that they're different. When they're collocated for systematic separation, for all sorts of things. And to even have a signal. So there's a whole class, and a whole variety of couplings. You can look for these. And just to give you an idea of how feasible these type of searches are, and that they're already able to do pretty well, this is a plot that shows this is the exclusion. These are exclusions. So this is the dark matter mass in EV. You see the corresponding frequency in Hertz up here. This is the log of the relative strength of the coupling compared to gravity. Zero is one times gravity. And D is parameterizes this coupling relative to gravity. And this is for something that couples to the electron charge. So in these experiments, it would appear dark matter will manifest itself as an oscillation of the fine structure constant. The gray stuff is what is excluded by modifications of Newton's law and equivalence principle violation searches. And the purple stuff is what was, what has been excluded by taking existing data of clocks. So the first one that was ever done was the dysprosium search right here, this light purple one. So shortly after we wrote the paper, Dima Butker from Berkeley contacted us and tells us, hey, I have this data on file of comparison between two dysprosium isotopes. What can we do with it? The data was taken over a period of a few months, not very periodically. Hence, that's why there is a dip here when you take the Fourier transform. But by just reanalyzing data on file, they were able to do for this type of dark matter several orders of magnitude better than was already done. The later on in 2016, the HIS group from France, I hope I pronounced the name right, compared rubidium and a cesium clock, and they were able to do better, especially at these lower frequencies, because they took data for, I think, more than a year, and they were taking data more periodically. Okay. Now there are several groups, as Jun Ye's group, for example, that's gearing up to do a similar experiment where they pick special pairs of atomic clocks to compare that enhances the sensitivity to different couplings. But given that we're talking about, let's say, what is ultimately possible, the ultimate thing would be to have a nuclear clock. Okay? A nuclear clock. Nuclear energy splittings are sensitive to all sorts of things. They are sensitive to the fine structure constant, to variations of the proton mass, that means the quark masses or the QCT scale. Now the question is, usually there are 1 MeV in energy, or 10 to the 6 EV. So there are no lasers that you can shine on nuclei to drive the transition. Turns out that nature has a natural landscape on us, a landscape of nuclei. So we have so many nuclei where once in a while, by accident, we find that there is a nuclear transition that is very low splitting. In particular, in the thorium-229 nucleus, there is a transition where there is cancellation between nuclear forces contribution and electromagnetic contributions that brings two energy level of the thorium nucleus 7 eV apart instead of 1 MeV. So this is an accident, one part in 10 to the 6. Okay? So, which is fantastic news because, and it's extremely long-lived. In fact, it's very hard. People have indirectly deduced its existence because the thorium-229 appears in radioactive decay chains. people have deduced the existence of this energy splitting by looking at different types of different parts of the chain. So they haven't measured it yet, but they know it's extremely long-lived. They are constrained in the parameter space. There's been a great work that was done in the last couple of years. Now, if you had a dark matter, what does this tell you, though, that... I should say that in principle, optical clocks, other types of clocks in the meantime, can also get great. They're improving their sensitivity continuously. Their accuracy is improved. Now, the great thing about this nuclear transition and this accidental cancellation is that if you were to vary the fine structure constant by order one, the energy level splitting would vary by a factor of 10 to the 6. So the effects of dark matter in the nucleus of thorium-2 tonight are amplified by at least by roughly a factor of 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6. So it becomes an extremely sensitive probe for dark matter searches. Okay? And this is, you see here, that's why... So this is something that tells you that if you have a coupling to the quark masses, for example, this would vary basically this will change the effect of the strong interactions on the energy splitting as a function of mass. You see, today we're somewhere here. Maybe we can do better than that. But with the nuclear optical transitions, you can really push it down. And this is exactly because of this huge enhancement of this accidental cancellation. Okay.
The enhancement is just because this kind of nucleus is super fine-tuned.
Yes, exactly.
As I change it a bit.
Yes, exactly. It's pretty neat. Actually, the same thing happens, I didn't mention, the same thing happens in the dysprosium isotopes. The dysprosium isotopes actually compare an optical transition, which we're talking about energies of around NeV. Turns out because of an accidental cancellation there, which is roughly one part in 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5, the transition appears to be emitting the radio frequency or low infrared. So it's 10 to minus 5 eV or so. So that gives you, even though the dysprosium clocks are pretty crappy as clocks, because of this accidental cancellation, they were able to do very well for dark matter searches. So I've been talking about comparing two different clocks that are collocated. But you can also imagine taking the same type of clock and separating in space. There, you have to measure the frequency with the same laser. And this is an idea that has been proposed to look for gravitational waves as well. And there, the point is that by the time the laser measures the atom that's far away, the dark matter phase has shifted. So you see a phase difference between the two clocks. Even though they're exactly the same, they are from the same species. So this is again a similar plot that I showed before. This is a dark matter count that couples to the electron mass, and this is as function of the dark matter mass. And you see here what the reach of these experiments is, and it's going to be when they are built, they're going to be amazing. So now transition to the next. Subject, notice this line here, the Earth, okay? The Earth actually can be a dark matter detector, okay, of this type. So the question is how? So if you have a dark matter candidate that couples either to the fine structure constant or the electron mass, along with changing the energy splitting of making the energy splitting of atomic transitions oscillate, it also makes the Bohr radius change. It makes the Bohr radius oscillate because the Bohr radius depends on both the fine structure constant and the electron mass. So if you have this type of dark matter, you expect atoms to breathe with it. Now, the actual size of this amplitude of this oscillation, like for a single atom, for the frequency that we'll be talking about, we're talking about 10 to the minus 30 meters. I mean, LIGO can measure 10 to the minus 18 meters. Okay, we're talking about tiny effects. The good thing is that atoms put themselves in very ordered states when we talk about solids. So the effect of the dark matter is amplified by the Avogadro number, which is 10 to the 23. So you get something that you can actually measure after that. In fact, the effect is even more enhanced when the frequency of the dark matter of this breathing becomes of the same order as the vibrational eigenfrequency of the object that you're looking at. Okay, so then you have a resonant detector. In fact, people have used this idea to look for gravitational waves. Okay. The first ever gravitational wave detector that was ever built was such a thing. So the if the tidal force of a gravitational wave as it passes through this huge bar of metal stretches it out periodically, if the frequency of the gravitational wave matches the vibrational frequency of this object, it resonantly excites it, so you can try to pick up that vibration. Back then, Weber was able to, in fact, he had the signal, but it didn't go that well. No one saw it ever again. But he had the sensitivity in 1 part in 10 to the 17 or so, in fractional change of the size. Today, the current generation, this is a very well-developed technology. The current generation of these resonant mass detectors can detect variations of the size of 1 meter object at the level of 10 to the minus 23 meters, okay? We're talking about something that's roughly 8 orders of magnitude smaller than the size of a nucleus. In principle, in absolute measurements, these are way more sensitive than what LIGO is. The problem is that they are resonant, so they only look at very specific frequencies. I don't have time to go into details, but this is a plot that shows how well you can do for dark matter searches that coupled with the electron charge, the fine structure constant, or the electron mass as a function of the dark matter mass. Up here, you see different types of resonant mass detector experiments. Some are current, some are futuristic. And now we come to Earth, okay? So the Earth is a very nice resonant mass detector. I mean, it's not as good as the ones we have in the lab, but it's big. So it has, there is a mode, a breathing mode of the Earth that was measured during those big earthquakes that has a period of about 20 to, I don't remember if it's 20 or 28 minutes. So it's a very long breathing mode. And it has a Q factor of about 1,000. Basically, the seismographs around, oh no, it's 10 to the 4, sorry. So 10 to the 4. Basically, the seismographs around the world were seeing this mode decay over a period of months. Okay? So it's a very, very good resonance. The problem is we don't know what can excite it, so it can only be used to constrain and not for any detection. But the funny thing is that in this very narrow frequency band, the Earth does better than anything we have done. In the lab, okay? It comes for free. So I should say you could do similar searches for the sun because there are modes, vibrational modes of the sun that have Q factors of 1,000. You can do the same thing for the moon. In fact, the moon would be perfect because it has no seismic activity, basically, because it doesn't have an active core. But again, all of these astrophysical objects can only be used as constraints and not for discovery because we don't know what can be the source of whatever vibration we detect. Now, if you've noticed, now the characteristic frequency that I've been talking about has increased. Before I was talking something that had periods of 1,000 seconds, anywhere between 1 second or a year. For resonant mass detectors, we went to a kilohertz. And the reason is for a meter-sized object, taking into account the sun speed in material, the characteristic frequency is around a kilohertz. And by making the object smaller, you go to higher frequencies. Now let's go to even higher frequencies, OK? Yes. I'll go back. Yeah.
So one length scale is set by basically the wavelength of the
Compton wavelength, yeah.
Yeah, OK. But I mean, I could also imagine that I have like spatial or temporal variations just of the axiom, or of the
yes, those are there. Yes,
which isn't necessarily the wavelength.
Oh, good. So then.
Anything not about basically the inhomogeneity
good.
Of the.
Yeah. So we have a lower bound. I don't know how to express it. Okay. So let me tell you about that. I need to write an equation because if I say something, it may be the opposite of what I mean. So the period is basically set by the frequency is set by the mass, the total energy. Okay. So this is basically 1/λ Compton. Okay, so if in terms of wavelength. Now there is two other parameters for that are the minimum that are relevant for a dark matter candidate. One is the spatial coherence. How coherent is it in space? How so? I say this oscillates with the same phase. Now if I start taking my detectors further or further away, when do they get out of phase? So that. And lambda coherence, the coherence length, is basically the de Broglie wavelength, which is in size is roughly 10^3 times the Compton wavelength, because the virial velocity inside the galaxy is roughly 10^-3 of the speed of light. And then there is the coherence time, which is 10^6 times the period. This is set because the dispersion, the virialized dark matter, has a characteristic dispersion of the velocity at the level of 10^-3 of the speed of light. And the reason that these two are different is because dark matter is relativistic. This is basically the kinetic energy of the dark. This is the minimum it can be, okay? But the requirement of dark matter is virialized. It could be, I mean, for some reason, it could be that it's more coherent than that. But so in order for you, for example, now, just to give you an idea how big these are, for a kilohertz frequency, the coherence length, so for a kilohertz, you're looking at about 300 kilometers. Now, if you go to 1,000 times that, you're going to basically coherence length, that is the Earth-Moon distance now. So as long as your two detectors are within that distance, then you expect to see the same phase. And it doesn't affect whatever I talked about, okay? But it does limit you. The most important thing in this is not, given the parameters that I was talking about, this is not a big limitation. This is the big limitation. So beyond this time scale, you cannot integrate your signal coherently. So you have to do some statistical analysis, okay? You won't see the oscillation, you won't see it as purely periodic anymore, okay? So, and this we have taken into account in all the plots that that you saw, okay? Okay, so for the last 5 minutes, I'll tell you, I'll skip, okay. I can tell you about molecules, but I'll skip molecules. And tell you about this, okay? What happens if the dark matter or the new particle that we're looking for has no coupling other than gravity? What do we do, okay? In principle, it's an issue of despair because gravity is such a weak force. The good thing is that for some parts of the parameter space, we can use astrophysical black holes, okay? And the reason is that astrophysical black holes have a characteristic size. And that characteristic size is anywhere between 1 kilometer and 10^10 kilometers for the black holes that we have seen in our universe. And through something called the superabundance effect, their evolution can be detected and can tell us about the possible existence of such particles. It's exciting because we know they're there. We started measuring them. And there is a big future in this field. Now, the question is, how do black holes detect new particles? It happens through an effect called superabundance. For people that are familiar with atomic physics, it has nothing to do with Dickey superabundance. I don't know if you ever know what that is, but We've had this conversation with some atomic physicists before that were confusing it. Two different effects that share the same name, but they're in different fields. I'm talking about inertial motion superradiance, or sometimes for GR is called the Penrose process, but it is a process that can appear in a variety of systems, okay? And it's not special to general relativity. Now, imagine you have a cylinder that has a rough surface, okay? And that cylinder is spinning. Now let's take a ball and scatter it tangentially from the cylinder. If the ball at the point of contact is moving faster than the cylinder is moving, then we know due to friction, the ball will slow down. Now, if you spin the cylinder up, eventually at the point of contact, the cylinder will be moving faster than the ball. So the cylinder will give the ball a push. So this is a process now where friction, and this is where the cylinder is in the superradiant regime. Basically, this is a process where friction gives energy out. It doesn't take energy away. A similar thing can happen for waves, and this is a cartoon now. A similar thing can happen for waves. For waves, the way you compare, so a rough cylinder that has friction, in the case of waves, it can be a cylinder with finite conductivity, something that has a resistance. And the wave that you scatter from it is an electromagnetic wave that can be absorbed from a cylinder. So this is what acts as your friction, right? Electromagnetic losses. So there, in order for you, the way the process works there is the wave gets scattered from the cylinder and it comes out with higher amplitude than what it came in. This happens when the angular velocity of the cylinder is faster than the angular velocity of the wave. The wave comes out amplified. And as I said, this is not special to gravity. This can be done for a variety of systems, like Zeldovich worked this out for conducting cylinders. There's an experiment in England that tried to do it with surface waves in water, where there's a whirlpool in the middle, a drain, and the waves scatter from the drain, from the whirlpool in the middle. So it's not special to gravity, okay? For black holes, the role of the cylinder is played by a rotating black hole. And rotating black holes, if you look them from above, have a region around them called the ergo region where even light has to rotate. So if you take a wave like light or gravitational wave and you scatter it from the black hole, or a scalar wave for that matter, it will come out with higher amplitude that it came in if, again, the angular velocity of the black hole, if the black hole spins faster than the angular velocity of the wave. Now, and this has been known for a while. Okay, from the late 60s, early 70s. Amusingly, Present Tucholsky in 72 wrote this short Nature paper where they devised the black hole bomb based on this effect. So you take your spinning black hole, you enclose it in a perfectly spherical mirror, and you redo your scattering experiment. So now the wave each time goes through the ergo region gets amplified. Because of the way the works, that amplification becomes essentially exponential to the number of scatterings. And eventually the radiation pressure becomes so large that the mirror explodes. And this is what they call a black hole bomb. Of course, this is not realistic for any black holes that we know of. But luckily for us, I was telling you about electromagnetic radiation, which is radiation of massless particles. If you have a massive particle, the massive particle can create a bound state with a black hole. So its mass acts like a mirror and forces the wave, the bosonic wave, to stay close to the vicinity of the black hole. What you get, and the process is most efficient for a particle whose Compton wavelength, a boson whose Compton wavelength is comparable to the size of the black hole, you see that the black hole spins down while at the same time there is a bound state of a scalar field created around the black hole.
Sorry.
Yes.
This, how is this not violating no hair theorems?
So first of all, this state is not time independent. Okay.
But, I mean, if I go to late times, does this eventually evaporate?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I mean, it's not really a
Yes.
Intermediate regime.
Yes, exactly. So there's annihilation, but that annihilation can be so slow that for all practical purposes we're fine. And it's very important to note that this works very well for these particles because there's no, for axions, for example, there's no conserved charge, right? It's a global, there's a global symmetry associated with it. So the black hole just, you see it in the equations, it appears like a classical instability of the Klein-Gordon equation, the Kerr background. So now the way you describe those bound states is unless you sit, and you see it very easily, unless you sit very close to the black hole, what you see is a binding potential of 1 over r, a Newtonian potential. So those bound states closely resemble atomic hydrogen orbitals, okay? There are several differences, of course. We're talking about different size. A hydrogen orbital is 10 to the minus 10 meters. We're talking about something that's tens of kilometers or billions of kilometers in size. But you can describe its properties. You can define a new fine structure constant, which is basically g Newton. The mass of the black hole is the mass of the particle. The properties of the, there is the principal quantum number, the orbital quantum number, and the magnetic quantum number. You even get a Rydberg formula out. Now, the main differences, other than the obvious quality of the, what is the binding energy, what does the binding in this case, and the issue of scales, is that the levels now of this atom are occupied by bosons instead of electrons. So instead of having just 2 in each orbital, you can have more than 10 to the 77, okay? Which is more than all the protons in the stars in the universe. So it's a lot of, a very high occupation number. The other difference is the effects of the horizon. So when you, because the black holes have horizons, when you solve for the wave functions, for the hydrogen atom, you require that the wave function is regular at the origin. And that gives you real eigenvalues. Now, because we have a horizon, you impose incoherent binary conditions, and that gives you imaginary eigenvalues. So there you see that the state, it turns a Hermitian problem into a non-Hermitian problem. And this is summarized here. Okay, I don't have much time. So this is again, so not all of the levels of this gravitational atom are superradiating. They have to satisfy the superradiance condition. Omega plus is the angular velocity of the black hole. Omega here is the total energy of the particle, of the boson going around the black hole. Just to convince you, the time scale, the fastest it can happen for example, a stellar mass black hole is about 100 seconds. If you compare it to the dynamical evolution time scale of astrophysical black holes, it's 10 to the 8, which is 10 to the 8 years, you see that there is a lot of time for the effect, if the particle's in the right mass range, for the effect to evolve and affect the properties of astrophysical black holes. There is a lot of things that we can discuss about how this effect manifests itself. What is more relevant for LIGO is that for axions in particular, axions are their own antiparticle, so they can annihilate to a single graviton, the presence of gravitational field of the black hole, and emit, produce very monochromatic, very coherent radiation. So basically they turn, if superradiance happens for astrophysical black holes, black holes are turned into gravitational wave beacons. It can have, if the signal is inside our galaxy, you can easily see it. In fact, the signal is so strong, you can even see outside our galaxy, but that, for that, you have to be lucky if you take into account distribution of black holes and everything. So, and this is our, and I will finish with this actually, this is our way of trying to take into account all the uncertainties that there are for the distribution of black holes, what is their spin, and try to express it in a plot of what LIGO can expect to see. So this is a mass of a scalar field. We're assuming it's an axion. Here, this is the expected number of sources that will be above the noise level of advanced LIGO. And there are, of course, assumptions that we make, pessimistic, realistic, that basically this band tries to capture all these uncertainties. And you see there's a large range of parameter space where you expect to see more than one above your noise floor. Okay? So this tells you that this effect can have observational consequences at existing experiments alike. Of course, LISA and all those are still in play. And I will stop here. I hope I gave you a flavor of the possibilities of what's happening in the low precision frontier, or the low energy frontier for particle physics. This is a young field. Many of these ideas have only been had in the last, at most, 10 years. And I think there are many more ideas to be had. So thank you. Yes.
Is there some obvious reason why the gravitational atom couldn't have fermions instead of bosons in the fermion?
Because fermions do not superradiate. So in order to get this exponential, the exponential, it's like a, kind of like almost like a Lasin effect, because the occupation number is proportional to the occupation number times the superradiance rate. So if you had fermions, this Bose enhancement factor wouldn't be there. So fermions basically do not superradiate, do not do this. So you need the Bose enhancement factors to get this.
Yeah. So when you have this superradiance, right, if I understand correctly, everything yeah. you're increasing the amplitude of your cosmic wave,
yeah.
the level spins down.
Yes.
But isn't there like a critical angular velocity after which superradiance doesn't happen? Like
yes, yes, yes. I didn't have time to talk about all of that, yes. So there is a range of masses. A single black hole of a certain spin probes. Let me see if I have a slide to show you that explains this a bit better. And I don't. I was too efficient, removed everything. So each black hole, so the requirement is that if you, so you can plot spin, this, and this is dimensional spin, goes from 0 to 1, 0 for Schwarzschild, 1 for Kerr, and this is black hole mass. And let's say you had a fixed, you had a fixed axion mass, okay? So basically, you would get curves that look like this. So let's say this is the L equals 1 level, the first one that can superradiate. So all of the black holes in here would be affected, but none of them here. For the L equals 2, black holes that are here would be affected, but none of them below here. So there is a range, depending on the mass of the spin of the black hole, that gets affected. Eventually, when the spin, so when the spin, the cloud extracts spin, the black hole spins down and it can no longer be affected by that level. It could be that there is no other level, atomic level, that can grow as fast within the age of the universe or whatever the relevant time scale is, to extract more spin. And basically, you could just get stuck there.
No, I guess my question is, why is this just not a temporary effect, in the sense that my black hole slows down,
yeah.
the amplitude is growing,
yeah.
and the wave comes back and keeps...
Because of the... It turns out, I mean, you can work it out, it's the second law of thermodynamics, because as the black hole, and I flashed it, but as the black hole sheds spin, the area grows. So the entropy, you can track it during this entire process. The black hole just increases its area, its entropy decreases. And when you work it out, for example, if there is a companion that disturbs the cloud and pushes it back to the black hole, it always happens with a level that doesn't spin the black hole up. So the area, I mean, you can, I mean, we've worked this out. It's, I'm doing a very, I'm explaining this too quickly, but you can see that every way you can imagine that the cloud falls back into the black hole, it always never increases the area of the black hole. Yeah. It reduces the area, sorry, it always increases. Yeah. Again. Yes?
Sorry, just to understand, so then this axion field starts to grow,
mm-hmm.
and then it radiates into gravitational radiation.
Yes.
That's how it disappears.
Yes, basically.
What is the time scale for that?
So that can be much longer. It depends on, it can be anything from 1,000 years. It can be 1,000,000 years. So in fact, in this plot, and I haven't shown there are other situations, in this plot, the things that you would see are actually pretty old black holes that have still a remnant of the cloud. It's not the maximum size that it used to be, but it's still a bit of it there. So these are the most, the ones that you see here. You can do a direct search. For example, if you have a merger, then you know the point in time and in space where a black hole was created with a given spin. So you can track superradiance in real time. There, the time scales for that, because those things are further away, you have to be in more optimal regions of parameter space, but the time scales for that can be much faster. Okay.
What about electromagnetic radiation?
Oh, good. So electromagnetic radiation is a bit trickier. So for axions, because in principle they can convert to photons, turns out there are complications because there is already matter inside the around the black hole. If you have a magnetic field in this region or the interstellar medium, turns out the frequency of the photons, of the plasmon frequency, is always, it turns out in most of the cases, is larger than the frequency of the photons you would emit from this. So they don't even propagate. So for axions, it doesn't do much. There could be non-trivial couplings between the accretion disk and the cloud, in particular for spin one particles. This is something that actually a couple of postdocs here are investigating. I mean, it's a good question, but for the cases that all the things that we have thought of so far, other than the thing that the postdocs have are working on, doesn't look like it will give any anything that we... You have to... I mean, these are very low frequency photons. So even if they escape the vicinity of the black hole, they would never penetrate the atmosphere. We're talking about wavelengths of 10 to the minus of thousands of kilometers. So they don't penetrate the atmosphere. You have to send your detector in space. But even then, in some cases, they won't even propagate inside the interstellar medium, because even for the, I mean, the plasmon frequency of the interstellar medium is 10 to the minus 12 eV, so which is about, on average, right? So it's about there. Okay. So yeah, it's a good question. There could be some, but more for the things that we've come up with, no. Yeah. Yep.
So at the beginning, you talked about this neutron electric moment.
Yes.
And that it's experimentally observed to be pretty small.
Yeah.
And that somehow axions fix this or explain.
Yes.
Can you...
elaborate? Yeah. Okay. So basically what happens is... okay, let me go back to that slide. So what you want... So this is the term that you hear. So what you want is somehow to set this value of theta to zero, okay? So first of all, when you turn it into an axion, turns out for these axions, there is a shift symmetry. So if you shift the axion by constant, you can rotate that constant in other dynamical variables of the theory, and then it's not physical anymore. Now, the thing is that when the axion couples to QCD, that term there generates an axion potential, which roughly goes like the axion is roughly m pi n squared A over FA. Okay? So the thing that you see is that this potential has... its minimum is very close to zero. So this looks like this. So basically, and this is periodic, right? So the minimum of the potential is very close to zero. So this is how it solves the problem. If you have any other contributions to the QCD axion potential from other sources, like string theory or a breaking of the PQ symmetry at the high energy scale, then it would mess this up, because it would shift the minimum from zero. For example, supersymmetry, theories of supersymmetry, add small corrections to it. So you'd never put it exactly to zero, but it can be very small. I mean, we can discuss this. I know, it's a very long... It's a very long thing. It's very hard to answer.
So maybe we can think again.
Yeah.